Hi, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. This is Erin Freesmith. Today we'll be discussing a new book by Anita Hanig. It's called Beyond Surgery, Injury, Healing, and Religion at an Ethiopian Hospital. It was recently published by the University of Chicago Press. Welcome, Anita. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to jump straight in. Can you first just start by telling us about yourself and your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an anthropologist by training, and I actually took my first anthropology class in high school in Sedona, Arizona. But as you can probably tell from the accent, I'm not from here originally. I moved to the United States when I was 16, and actually to attend that high school in Arizona, and my parents stayed behind, and my entire family stayed behind.
Wow.
And so they just had the grace to let me do my thing over here, overseas. And so once I started taking my first anthropology class, I have not looked back. And I did anthropology as a major at Reed College in Oregon, and then later on for my PhD at the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And but before I settled on this topic, I was actually working for an NGO called Mercy Corps in Iraq.
Sure.
And on one of my R&R trips, which we had at the time, I got to go to Eritrea, which is which used to be part of Ethiopia and was colonized by the Italians in the late 19th century. And I was visiting a colleague who lived over there at the time and was working for that same NGO, and I was absolutely fascinated by the country and by the food and just by the rich history of that area of the world. And initially, I had really wanted to do research actually in Eritrea. But because of the political climate at the time, and arguably even now, it was actually really difficult for researchers to get permission to do research there. And it was going to be the kind of research where the government was going to surveil you at every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And I had known this from other researchers who had previously done research in Eritrea. And so when I started my studies in anthropology at the University of Chicago, I still sort of had in the back of my mind that I wanted to return to that part of the world and do research there. And then basically settled on Ethiopia as kind of the next closest thing to Eritrea. Mm-hmm. And spent a couple of summers in Ethiopia looking for a project. Originally, I was really interested in doing stuff in one of Ethiopia's many internal refugee camps. They have refugee camps on the Sudanese border, on the Somalia border, and in northern Ethiopia also of Eritreans. But again, politically, it was too contentious of a subject at the time. And then one summer when I was in Ethiopia, I basically stumbled upon the Fistula Hospital. A friend introduced me, and we received one of their sort of official tours. And I immediately thought, oh my God, this is an anthropological project, right? You have mm-hmm. these women who suffer from these very difficult childbirth injuries that lead to them leaking urine and sometimes feces, and that are a result of obstructed labor and prolonged childbirth. And in most cases, what happens is that the baby does not survive the labor. And the story that at the time I was told when we were given this tour, and you know later on I read up on the story, is that these women become social outcasts of their community and are essentially relegated to the outskirts of their village where a hut is being built for them, and they essentially languish in basically a pool of their own urine and are being totally neglected by everyone and divorced by their husbands. So I thought at the time, oh, wow, this is kind of, you know, the classic story of marginalization, and, you know, anthropologists tend to work with disadvantaged sections of populations. So I thought, oh, wow, this is a really interesting medical topic and a topic that really is very rich for exploration.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote, you know, my funding proposals and eventually made it to what we as anthropologists call the field. And upon entering my research context, really noticed that the story that I had been told about this condition didn't at all coincide with what the women that I was doing research with told me about their experience.
Okay.
And because originally my project design had actually been to spend some time at the hospital doing research there and then follow some of the women as they were being reintegrated after a successful surgery. And it just turned out that there was no such enigmatic return, because people weren't the ostracized pariahs that I had thought they would be in the mm-hmm. first place. And initially I was kind of confounded by that. I thought, well, maybe I'm just not meeting the right type of women. Maybe I need to just change the demographics of the people I'm working with. Because all the women I was working with, I mean, they certainly had horrible hardships as a result of this injury that makes you as an adult woman incontinent. But none of them, but actually in almost all cases, their kin had stepped up to provide for them. And neighbors had come together to provide food, and nobody had been pushed to the outside of any sort of village.
Right.
And but that is exactly the stories that had been told, and that keeps being told through outlets of the New York Times and other sort of top journalistic media. And so I started talking to older women, because I thought, well, they had been living with fistula their whole lives. Maybe they had been the ones, you know, who had experienced that kind of treatment. And even those women had been lovingly cared for by their neighbors and by their kin. And so then I actually changed my research design and thought, okay, I think what I really need to do, rather than kind of follow these women back to their villages, which in and of itself would have been logistically pretty complicated, I want to actually see what goes into the making of the story here at the hospital, and how women experience the space of the hospital as kind of a space of encounter,
right.
Between, you know, themselves and their ideas about their bodies, about religion, about healing, and what the hospital is, what the hospital essentially thinks happens to them and treats them according to kind of that framework, or whether or not that story comes from somewhere else and it's just kind of something that is being used to raise money for this pretty obscure condition. And I say obscure because in the grand scheme of things, many people have not heard of obstetric fistula, but it affects about at least 1 million women, and most of whom live in sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so were you able to ascertain where that narrative comes from? Did it come from people within Ethiopia who were trying to raise funds, or was that a Western external model that was being thrust upon it?
I think initially, so I had the fortune to encounter some really old letters, some really old fundraising letters that are from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s that were written by one of the co-founders of the hospital in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And parts of that story come up in the letters. And he, Reginald Hanlon at the time, he had gotten his story a little bit from other people who had worked on obstetric fistula before. So there's a way in which that story goes back quite a few decades, but the current iteration of it is a little bit different, and I can talk later about how it's different now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a way in which this idea of fistula pilgrims, the way that what he called them at the time, even existed back then, but the way fistula has been covered all over the world is almost the same. So so Nicholas Kristof writes a lot of columns about obstetric fistula in the New York Times, and he has called fistula patients the 21st century lepers,
mm-hmm.
or the modern lepers of our times, and the most wretched people on the planet is how he calls them. And people have just kind of taken that narrative and run with it, and not super questioned it, because it really feeds into certain archetypes that we have of certain sort of stereotypes of, African barbarity or savagery,
mm-hmm.
or things like that, where people who are sick will be ostracized by their villagers, right? Because that does happen around certain illnesses. It occasionally happens. But it has, and this is the way lepers used to be treated. And in fact, Kristof did some of his research at a place in Niger that used to be a leprosarium, and so now is a fistula hospital. But then he took that designation of, oh, these used to be lepers, to now say, oh, fistula patients are the modern day lepers.
Right.
And it's really, it's very curious, because once the story has kind of been kind of set in motion, it almost perpetuates itself, to the extent that the fistula hospital has been using it and constructing all its programming around it. So you walk into the ward of the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, and you have that story told in a series of paintings. They made a movie about the story that has a patient go through that story of ostracization, the husband abandons her, she gets a miracle surgery and is reinstated as a human being and comes back to her repentant family. So family, fistula patients come to the hospital, watch this movie, see the paintings, but they don't often buy it. So in our interviews, they would often say things like, wow, that was really horrible what happened to this woman in the film, but my mother didn't treat me like that. Or, that was really nice how her friend behaved when she got fistula and stuff, but and that was like how my family reacted or something. But all of them said that they hadn't been sort of pushed to the outside of a village.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what's interesting here is that there are ways of the way shame works and the way that exclusion, the way that sort of people self-police their bodies, that to an outside audience might look as if somebody is discriminating against them. But when you actually look closer and you understand a little bit more about the cultural dynamics, it turns out that there are really complex negotiations that are happening within a marriage, between kin and who steps up to take care of somebody, and how shame, basically the idea of shame, carries different valences in different settings. That's really, really interesting, and that's really worth looking at. And mm-hmm. that doesn't at all, maybe on the outside it may look like, oh, so-and-so is sequestered in this house, when in reality there's a lot of work that goes into making sure that certain information doesn't leave the family, but without kind of this this idea of discrimination. It's a way of preventing certain things from spilling outside the household. Sure. But, and mainly, this kind of women really self-police themselves and weren't really told by other people they couldn't, attend funerals or markets or anything like that, but they themselves were so ashamed of their condition that they often opted out of social encounters.
Sure. So as you started this ethnographic study, upon what did you base the framework of the study? In the scholarly sense, where was the theoretical framework that you believe you fit into here?
Yeah, great. So I think there are two main interventions that I see for my work, and one is in my field and one is kind of outside of classic academia, but the two are very connected.
Mm-hmm.
So my main intervention here is really into the social suffering literature. And as part of that, in anthropology and outside of anthropology even, scholars have found it really useful to use the analytical framework of structural violence.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an analytical framework that's used to argue that there are certain large-scale socioeconomic and political factors that really force individuals into situations beyond their control. And so especially when you talk about things like affliction, illness, and things like that, the structural violence framework has a way of explaining those things and their destructive effects. And basically they talk about it in terms of social crisis as both kind of being a function of social crisis and emblematic of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the suggestion here is often, well, first of all, so the advantage of that kind of framework is that it really moves from individual culpability or cultural culpability for illness to a framework that really appreciates the socioeconomic and political inequalities. And so there's something really useful in thinking about fistula as something that actually used to happen in the United States and in Europe before people had access to a cesarean section, but usually doesn't happen anymore because when there's obstructed labor here, people can get themselves to a hospital.
Right.
And in Ethiopia, in rural Ethiopia, that's just not the case. Even if women arrive at a local health center, they cannot get a cesarean section. So what ends up happening is that the baby essentially dies inside of them,
mm-hmm.
and inflicts this damage on their bladder and often sometimes their rectum. So the structural violence framework is really useful in really getting us to think about these global inequities where things like that can happen. But it often also creates this notion that people's mechanisms for dealing with injury are rendered completely obsolete by these larger structural forces,
mm-hmm.
and that their lives really become bereft of meaning and purpose and really falter under the weight of things that they cannot control. And And then there's also often an implicit assumption that medicine, or especially biomedicine, saves the day. And that's a really uncomplicated view of some of these global health missions. And part of what underlies the structural violence framework is that there's a certain universal quality to suffering that transcends culture. So that it's almost like we don't really, we don't need to look at the particularities of people suffering. Suffering and violence are kind of the same all over.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, you kind of impose your own meta-narrative of what suffering is. And what I'm trying to do in the book is to really think about how injury and illness are actually experienced, and how we can think of biomedicine not just as beneficial and uncontested, but to also look at how, and I can talk about this a little bit later, how in certain circumstances the benefits are very ambiguous. And so when we talk about fistula, there's a certain preconceived notion of victimhood and exclusion that really articulates with the Christoph narrative that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So the scriptive narrative around the injury and what happens to people who get it. And the only difference here is that Christoph really blames cultural practices like early marriage for fistula.
Right.
And almost in his early work almost didn't at all talk about insufficient health access. And the structural violence, you know, framework does talk about it. But so basically, what I'm trying to do is to really think about how to get us beyond thinking about suffering as an a priori category, and to not assume that there are certain values that are the same everywhere. Because so, for instance, if you talk about infant death, so most of the women that I talked to had lost a baby through, you know, their ordeals.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain pre-assumption that I think we make that people who lose their babies must be, that is a deplorable outcome, that people who don't feel grief for babies who are lost are heartless or are somehow, I don't know how to say it, but they're
less than human.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it. And Nancy Shepard Hughes, who also works in the structural violence framework, has written about infant death in Brazil. And you can tell from the way she writes about it that she's shocked that people wouldn't mourn their stillborns, or that people mm-hmm. would let infants die and things like that. And then she sort of goes into some explanations, but you can tell that she herself cannot get beyond kind of this imposed framework of, oh, there needs to be grief, there needs to be mourning for an infant.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ethiopia, the women I talked with, almost all of them said that they actually didn't feel grief. And the reasons for that were worked kind of on multiple levels. On one level, they said that they were actually more concerned about their own potential death while all of this was happening, that they nearly didn't make it. And a lot of them felt that their infant had damaged them.
Mm-hmm.
And then on maybe even a larger level that might be even more significant is that if an infant dies, if you're an Orthodox Christian and an infant dies before it's baptized, it's
right.
not considered to be an appropriate subject of grief. And so so the women still thought that even an unbaptized child could go to heaven because in their eyes it hadn't really done anything wrong. But this child was not a Christian. And so it wasn't something that was kind of appropriately mourned. And of course, you know, they were sad, but they weren't, one of them said something like, if a bird falls from a tree, we don't think that we lost anything. So if this baby died inside of me, I didn't lose anything because I never saw this child. And what in Amharic, the word for seeing also means that you never came to know this child, so you never experienced this child as a person.
Right.
And that's really what she meant, that this this child was never, she could never make it her own, so she didn't feel like she really lost anything because she never knew this child in a way.
Right.
So it all kind of goes together between, you know, children not being, or unbaptized children who die not being appropriate objects of grief, but also socially, right, this child hadn't been absorbed into her family she never developed a relationship to that child, which is very different from the way that we think about, you know, women building attachments to even their fetus in, in utero, right. So, so I found this, so these kinds of things, right, this is what anthropology cares about, is really trying to interrogate certain categories that we tend to feel are, should be universal or are universal, and to really show that there are other ways of thinking about human frailty, human finitude, and human emotions and things like that.
Right. So it's just a different cultural outlook that needs to be taken into consideration. Could it also have been, to a certain extent, also some sort of a survival mechanism? You know, they needed to move past because there was nothing that they could do about the situation.
Yeah, certainly. And I probably might not boil it down to just that. Because religiously, there are just so many ways of thinking about unbaptized children. But yeah, I mean, certainly there's also a way of, you know, the infant mortality rate is very high. Many women that I talked to had 7 or 8 children and only half of them survived.
Right.
So, but I think it's really important to think about not kind of imposing this universalist narrative of suffering. And I think part of what the structural violence literature does is that it suggests that we do that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to be lost here if we don't also then think about how illness opens up complex negotiations between you and your family, between you and your husband, between you and your priest, and kind of how people deal with that, and how as horrible as this condition is, that people really find ways of accommodating themselves and arranging their lives around it, and are finding creative ways of solving it that don't all boil down to surgery. And often surgery, yes, can be very effective, but often also it's not effective, and then people still have to live with this injury.
Right, and so because that narrative isn't necessarily the pervasive narrative on the ground, why does it persist, particularly in the Western world? Is this merely a fundraising tool?
I tend to think that it is in part a fundraising tool, because there are if you kind of look at the landscape of global humanitarian funding, there are so many conditions and so many different illnesses that vie for attention. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the way that the fistula narrative has been carved out as, oh yeah, that's the one where women, you know, become these pariahs and sit in a house by themselves and then get saved by surgery. That is the narrative.
Right.
And that is how donors have responded to it. And the fistula hospital receives almost all of its funding from foreign donors and private donors. And the story has worked, and the story has usually kind of been accepted at face value. So I think there's something about that. And often what's so interesting is that women, even women who didn't experience this treatment or who don't fit the narrative, which is almost most of the women I talk to, they then took part of the narrative as their own. So when they, for instance, when they watched the movie that I talked about a little bit earlier, and then I would interview them and to ask about, why do you think you got fistula and stuff? People, so the movie suggested that early marriage was to blame for it. So then women would say, oh, early marriage, because the idea behind early marriage is that if you get married early, your pelvis is not developed. Right. And so when you're trying to push the baby out, the baby gets stuck. So this woman who had had 8 children before she sustained fistula, then told me that early marriage was to blame for her fistula, which in her case just made no sense. But you could see women sort of borrowing from the lexicon of the narrative, or trying to kind of take on certain aspects of the narrative, because that's how they've been kind of told to make sense of their experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, certain parts of it, of course, were true, right? That, you know, you have an abusive mother-in-law, and of course they could relate to that. They always said, you know, I hate my mother-in-law. She made me do this and this. But really, I mean, in my entire year of research, I never came across a single woman who had become the social pariah that Nicholas Kristof writes about and that we hear about and that the women, you know, see when they enter the hospital in terms of the paintings, the radio broadcasts, the posters, everything.
Right. That's so interesting that your narrative would be completely different than the one that's shown over here. So speaking about your subjects, what other areas did you find to find documentation for this project?
Yeah, so basically, my research process mainly involved two things. So I lived at the hospital in Bahada in northern Ethiopia where I did most of my research. So I actually moved in with the nurse aides of the hospital, who are all former patients who couldn't be cured and who now work at the hospital to perform, you know, auxiliary duties in the OR and in the ward. And they were extremely gracious about having me rent a room from them. And in the morning, I would sit in on the classes that the fistula patients took at the hospital. And in the afternoon, I would interview individual patients and patient groups. And I would go on field trips to health centers. I would go with my nurse aide friends to church services. And then the last 3 months of my research, I moved to this other settlement that features in Chapter 6, mm-hmm. which is a training and rehabilitation site for incurable fistula patients who have what's called a urostomy or stoma bag, which is similar to a colostomy bag but for urine. Mm-hmm. And so they have been essentially put into the settlement of patients, and they're being trained for a life outside of the hospital. So I spend my last 3 months living there. But beyond kind of this deep hanging out, as anthropologists call it, mm-hmm. I also gained access to these very crucial archival materials of letters that the founders of the first fistula hospital in Ethiopia, Reginald Hamlin and Catherine Hamlin, had sent to donors all over the world in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So that's kind of where the historical element of the study came in. But then most of the other material came from interviews with patients, with nurse aides, some doctors, and really kind of hanging out at the hospital, spending time there, and observing clinical routines and talk. Yeah, the main thing, though, was talking to patients.
Mm-hmm. And were there other Western people there while you were doing your research? I mean, was it because they have these external funders, largely foreign funders, were there people coming in to check out the progress and things like that while you were there?
There were foreign surgeons who mm-hmm. worked in other parts of Africa who were being trained for surgeries on fistula patients.
Okay.
So I think there were maybe two or three while I was there who basically interned with the main surgeon at the fistula hospital in Bahada, who was Australian, and who then go back to other sites inside somewhere else in Africa to do these surgeries. And what was interesting is that, the surgeons themselves don't really care that much about that story. I mean, some of them know that it's not all accurate, but they are just there to do the work.
Right.
And there weren't really, there were people from the Clinton Health Access Initiative, I think, at the time. They were renovating the entire hospital that the fistula hospital was just a tiny part of, the public hospital in Bahada.
Mm-hmm.
So there were consultants there, and there were some medical students who were doing rotations at that hospital. But besides that, most of that, because I wasn't at the main hospital in Addis Ababa most of the time, I was in Bahada, which is a regional hospital. I didn't see many of the kind of maybe foreign donors or other people come through. But I think the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital is more of a place for that. And they also, part of why so many people come for training is because they have really perfected the surgical techniques, because they were the first hospital ever, the first hospital in the world that focused exclusively on fistula in Ethiopia. And so that's why they have a long history of trying to perfect the technique and training other surgeons. And that history really persists still today.
Right. So how did the women who were being treated there who later worked there, how did they see you?
Good question. I'm not entirely sure how they saw me. I think they thought I was part of the hospital,
mm-hmm.
which was, of course, a little bit problematic. I think some of them thought I was a doctor. But then when I noticed that sometimes they would pull me aside and show me things on their bodies, and I never wore a coat or anything. And then I actually made a point of not attending the gynecological examinations that they did, and even not attending surgeries. I only attended two surgeries because it just felt too invasive.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really wanted to draw a line between myself and the senior medical people who were there, and I didn't want patients to think I was a doctor or any sort of medical practitioner. And so what I would initially, I did the interviews in the hospital in kind of a private room. But then we ended up doing them outside behind the hospital where there weren't people walking by all the time. And but it was actually a really difficult thing to navigate because in a certain way, I think people maybe felt obligated to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they thought it was part of their the routine or, you know, the things that you do when you come to this hospital. And I made sure that they knew that they didn't have to, but I think there was still, I mean, there's a lot of the patients feel extreme deference towards senior medical personnel and, sadly to say, Westerners also.
Sure.
So I think a lot of them just kind of felt obligated to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And at the second site where I did my research at Destamenda, the incurable patient post, there nobody wanted to talk to me actually, because they had been so inundated with researchers who wanted to know about this, you know, private medical device that they were carrying around with them to hold their urine or to collect their urine, that they actually wanted to keep that for themselves and didn't want to talk. And so they had actually instigated a boycott against my research for, I don't know, the first few weeks I was there. And it took a little bit of persuasion and coaxing by some of the people who were in charge there, and my explaining a little bit more what I was doing, and my actually dropping a lot of questions about the stoma bag
mm-hmm.
in the end, because I realized, well, if people really didn't want to talk about it, then I didn't want to push them, and so we talked about other things. And even the people at the fistula hospital, it took me a while to warm up to questions around fistula, so I would often use the interviews to talk generally about practices around childbirth, about sort of women's roles in the household, and general kind of kin structures before I would kind of slowly make my way into, you know, the experience with fistula.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like they, in general, were comfortable with you by the end? Do you feel like they were opening up, or did you feel at all that they were telling you maybe what they thought you wanted to hear, or were you able to break down that wall?
Well, it was interesting because if they had told me what I wanted to hear, I think they would have given me that story. Because initially I was really fishing for that story because that's what I thought was the normative fistula experience mm-hmm. in a way. I mean, very naively, but when I wasn't getting that, I kept kind of prodding and that's kind of when the slow realization occurred that, wow, this story is actually in large part bogus. But the issue was that people didn't really spend that much time at the hospital. They spend about, the average stay, I think, was 18 days.
Oh, wow.
13 to 18 days or something. So not that long. And so it wasn't often that I got to talk to people twice. Mm-hmm. I would usually only get to talk to a person once. And it was either before their surgery or after their surgery. And there were a couple of people that I made a point of interviewing more often, especially the ones that had complications and had to stay longer.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one woman whom I actually did follow back to her village. And I interviewed her 3 or 4 times in total. And she was older. She was 70 years old. And she had lived with fistula for her whole life.
Wow.
And that one was really interesting to see because she, just going back to her village and talking to her her relatives and her neighbors and things like that, really kind of gave me a much broader view of how they thought about fistula. And the other thing is, like, many people didn't have a name for it, but they found out the name fistula when they got to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They would often say, my problem, like that's how they would describe it. And often they were the only ones that they knew who had experienced this. So mm-hmm. they had no ways of describing it initially. And it was only really when they got to the hospital that they were able to name it and to put it into like a larger narrative, and which is why it's significant that the hospital kind of forces them into a certain narrative.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, of course, that in Ethiopia, one thing that anthropologists have written about a lot is these patron-client relationships.
Yeah.
That in order to kind of be successful socially, you have to put yourself under the protection of a patron. And I could maybe see a little bit of that dynamic in our talks, where more often in order to find protection or to get something that you need, you will you will maybe exaggerate certain things that happen to you in order to find somebody who, you know, will protect you or sponsor you or give you something. And so if anything, I was aware of those dynamics and thought, well, maybe even some of the things women were saying were potentially a little exaggerated here and there. But maybe also this is how the hospital initially came to the story, mm-hmm. because of this intense kind of patron-client system where you have to make yourself into a deserving subject of a certain kind. But the only thing that people ever asked me for, specifically this one woman asked me if I could put her in touch with a lawyer, because she was going to sue her husband because he hadn't divided the property equally. In Ethiopia, in divorces, mm-hmm. You have to divide everything up 50-50.
Yeah.
At least in the area where I worked in among Orthodox Christian and Amhara region. In the end, I don't know what they thought of me. In the second research site, people thought I was a spy at first. They thought I was there to expedite their exit from this community, and everybody wanted to stay and knew they had to leave eventually. And they thought I was there to do a survey to make sure that to kind of expedite their exit. Mm. But so that was uncomfortable for all of us, for them and for me.
Right.
But then there was this moment. I mean, and sometimes in the field you have these magical moments. Well, in this case it was a kind of a sad moment. One of the patients died. Mm. And I, you know, I attended all the funeral celebrations and the mourning rituals and all those things. And I think, and then we drove to the hospital to watch her body being carried out on a stretcher by her relatives. And and I think when the women kind of saw how I participated and that I cared, I think they softened a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it was actually after that event that they came to my house and said, okay, I'm willing to talk to you now.
That's incredible.
But only after I'd shown that kind of solidarity and that kind of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that chapter that you're referencing or your final site was a particularly interesting chapter for me, because it was even though the narrative was not being fulfilled with the outcast women coming, being fixed, and then returning home, you know, whole women, the women that you were interviewing, they certainly were being sort of cured. But the women in the final chapter were stuck in this new place, or maybe they didn't see themselves as being stuck, but they had to I don't know, they were being retrained, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the initial idea behind the settlement was that women would live there permanently, that the hospital would permanently take care of them, because it was thought that they could never return to their communities with this, you know, apparatus, which mm-hmm. is, like I said, kind of like a colostomy bag, but for your urostomy bag. And what was really interesting is that the hospital thought that the hygienic conditions were such that women wouldn't be able to properly take care of their bags at home, and they couldn't get the replacement bags easily, because you need to change the bag every 3 days.
Right.
And they were being imported from Ireland, actually. And the hospital had them for free for the women, and so did all the outreach hospitals all over Ethiopia. But then the hospital did more and more of those operations. They are called ileal conduit operations every year. And so they knew that the settlement that they had founded would fill up in no time. And so they needed to come up with a different solution for these women. And so the next, after a long string of experiments, the vision was that they would be trained as these self-sufficient entrepreneurs and settle in communities around the Fistula Hospital as, you know, waitresses or as, what other things, spice makers or as seamstresses and things mm-hmm. like that. But the women were terrified. They didn't want to suddenly be on their own in a totally strange community when you know, they had lived in the settlement for years.
Right.
And this had really become their community. And to be suddenly kind of told to stand on their own feet was really terrifying for them. And in that specific settlement, there was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of clashes of different ideologies of dependency, and community versus self-sufficiency and microcredit. I mean, there are a lot of microcredit approaches that were being tested out in that community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these approaches depend on, you know, this idea of the self-sufficient individual.
Right.
And not only did women not necessarily come from that background, but they also hadn't been sort of trained in this way for the longest time. And now suddenly they were, and they were taking these new classes where they're being told, they're being taught words like my profit, my customers, and they had to learn math through paper money and things like that. And they were really trained to become these business women. And there was a lot of resistance against that.
Mm-hmm. And where were these programs coming from? I mean, this feels like an extremely Western concept, and we've got this Western basis hospital. But it was being supported by the Ethiopian government, though, correct?
So the Ethiopian government, it was an interesting mixture because they had hired a lot of Western consultants over the years, but then they had partnered with this Ethiopian-sponsored microcredit association. That had gotten these loans from the Ethiopian government to, you know, run their own bakery. And they had women from these organizations come to Desamenda and give a talk about that. And they would tell women, you don't be dependent on this organization. You have to, you know, buy your own bread. You need to care for your own. You can't be dependent on anybody. And the boss of the settlement was essentially saying, yeah, we are really... You know, this is a recent trend of deinstitutionalization. Mm-hmm. So we are right with the times. You know, we want to, you know, these buzzwords around like we need to empower these women, we need to make them entrepreneurs, we need to make them self-sufficient. When part of what had made them not self-sufficient is having this medical device,
right?
That actually really curtailed where they could be and what they could do in a way. And there were just so many competing narratives around what it meant for women to have this bag, because initially the hospital said, oh, well, with this bag, you actually can't work. You can't do this, you can't do that. And suddenly women were told, no, you can do everything you want, and you have to stand on your own feet.
But you're not allowed to go home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's extremely complex.
Yeah, it's very complex. Yeah.
Right. So how did you feel like they were handling that? I mean, obviously, a lot of cases are very individual, and you did a very good job of profiling individuals and their reactions. But was there a new narrative that formed out of it, or is it too soon to tell?
I mean, some of that old fistula narrative was being recycled by some of the people who work there, because some of the reasoning why you couldn't send people back was because, oh, well, they were discriminated against when they had fistula. Can you imagine what would happen if they came back with this bag, kind of thing?
Right.
But the women themselves, I mean, again, I use some of their narratives to inform my larger ideas about what happens with women when they get fistula, because they also talked to me about what it was like when that happened. But many of these women actually hadn't been home in a while, mm-hmm. Because they had spent so much time in a hospital trying to get a cure. So some of them had been in and out of hospitals for like 3 or 4 years and trying to find a cure, going back, trying more surgeries. But eventually, especially with these women, there was just nothing left to repair. And so that's when they got this urine diversion for themselves. Many of the women were, they were quite savvy. They were doing all these handicraft projects for foreign tourists that would come to the settlement. This is another thing that the hospital had encouraged. So they would skip classes, the hospital didn't encourage them to skip classes, but they skipped classes to make these, these sewn blankets and these baskets and things like that. And they would sell them at the Fistula Hospital gift shop for a lot of money for them. And so they had their own ideas of kind of where they wanted to be and how they wanted to make money. And honestly, I mean, part of the issue was that the settlement was so luxurious in a way, where they could never replicate those structures outside of the hospital. I mean, they had running water, they had electricity, they had these concrete houses, they didn't have to buy their own food. So the hospital had in many ways made them so profoundly dependent, which was another one of the sort of ironic things here. But many of their previous narratives of how they coped with fistula were very similar to the narratives I heard from the people at the hospital where I previously lived.
Okay.
They had, you know, they had developed these really innovative ways of dealing with fistula by concealing it. Some of them, but actually one of the things is that some of them, even though they had been in and out of hospital for years, they still had husbands who wanted to be back with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the husbands didn't know that the women now had, most of them didn't know that they had this ileal conduit, the stoma back. Mm-hmm. And but they said, you know, my husband, you know, he calls me all the time. He wants to be back with me, but I don't want to be with him anymore. Because I don't want to tell him about this bag. But there are husbands who hang on to their marriages even throughout years of hospitalization.
Hmm.
So that, I think, was something that really surprised me, too.
Yeah.
And really kind of counters this whole narrative of abandonment.
Yeah, most definitely. So looking back at your research, at your year, and then also of your time writing this up, do you think that the discourse around fistula should change internationally? And if it does change, how do you think that'll change fundraising efforts and that sort of thing? I mean, is there a push against changing the narrative?
Yeah, I actually shared this book with the person who used to be the medical director of the Fistula Hospital at the time, and he had always been really supportive of my work, and he received it, and he was really glad. And he said, he no longer works for the Fistula Hospital, but he said, okay, you need to get this to the right type of people who can actually do something about changing this narrative. And there have been, you know, small efforts to change it, mainly not from those organizations, but there has been a little bit more of an acknowledgement that surgery is not the miraculous panacea it's been made out to be. But there's still, like, this pervasive emphasis on early marriage and kind of this pathologization of culture that I'm trying to write against in the book. But I wrote the book for a broad audience of practitioners in global health, for NGO workers, and I'm hoping that, you know, this is really something people can pick up. I'm hoping that we can change it, because the condition itself is bad enough that I don't think you need to then also invent this entire sort of story of victimhood and exclusion to kind of get at people's hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the conclusion, the situation is, I mean, when women, you know, have this happen to them, that's a horrible thing for many of them. And so mainly just kind of focusing on that, but also focusing on how women actually cope with this, I think is really, really imperative.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe acknowledging more that surgery, isn't always the answer, and that there are other women who have to live with these incurable injuries for a while. And I just hope that we can get to a place where we can acknowledge that people deal with these misfortunes in very complex ways. And, you know, and I think we tend to reserve for ourselves this this notion that, you know, we're all individuals and we all we deal with these things kind of idiosyncratically, but we don't, in the fistula narrative, that complexity is not given to anybody, right? Everybody's kind of subsumed in this meta narrative, and just adding this local complexity, and also looking at how differently fistula operates, for instance, in the religious realm. I write a lot about that in the book, right? How does this affect people's ability to be pious Christians?
Right.
And a colleague of mine who works in Niger has written about this in a Muslim context. And and really just paying attention not to make assumptions, I think is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm.
And not to let our own cultural categories basically occlude the way that we look at other people's conditions and lives.
Sure. Sure. And so what are you working on now? Is this something that you're continuing, or?
So I've shifted gears a little bit. I'm still really interested in this overlap between medicine and religion, and I know we didn't mm-hmm. really talk about that, but the book talks a lot about how, for instance, in Amharic, the word Adane means both to heal and to save.
Sure.
And you can see throughout the book that both patients and doctors really don't think of medicine and religion as these separate categories, but how they're really infused the entire way through, through surgery, through treatment, through how you think about healing. But so my next project that I'm working on actually focuses on medical aid in dying in the United States mainly. So I'm out in Oregon right now doing research on that. And there's similar conceptions that I'm interested in really thinking about how differently people approach and think of bodily suffering, how they think about their own mortality in a way, and where medicine comes in, where medicine is sometimes too much, and how people explain things kind of cosmologically, whether through religion or through different ways of, explaining the world.
Right. Well, that's great. I thoroughly enjoyed your book. I think that it will be of great use to a lot of different people. So this is Anita Hannig. We're talking about her book, Beyond Surgery, Injury, Healing, and Religion at an Ethiopian Hospital. It's out now at University of Chicago Press. Thank you very much, Anita. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Erin.